Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we'll talk healthcare with Harold Pollack from the University of Chicago. We're going to talk about it both left and right. We're going to talk about where the GOP with its plan to finance massive tax cuts by stripping coverage for millions of people. And then we're also going to talk a little bit about single payer and the challenges to get there. Then we'll be joined by Gleb Sapursky from the University of Ohio. He has a plan to fight the spread of fake news. And finally, we'll speak with Susie Madrak. She's a contributing editor to Crooks and Liars and an OG blogger about Trump's tirade in an interview with the New York Times this week and the crazy days that followed. But first, it is the end of an era. White House Spock's Sean Spicer is out. Anthony Mooch Scaramucci, who fell all over himself proclaiming his love of Donald Trump, which is apparently shared by everyone because he's such a winner, is in. And we're going to miss Sean. He was not only a shameless liar like Mooch, the Mooch, and Sarah Huckabee Sanders, he was also comedy gold.
Is it your intention to always tell the truth from that podium, and will you pledge never to knowingly say something that is not factual?
It is. It's an honor to do this, and yes, I believe that we have to be honest with the American people. I think sometimes we can disagree with the facts.
Photographs of the inaugural proceedings were intentionally framed in a way, in one particular tweet, to minimize the enormous support that had gathered on the National Mall. This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period.
And then obviously there's been this discussion of Paul Manafort, who played a very limited role for a very limited amount of time. But beyond...
But are you the chairman?
Hey, Jonathan, hold on. Can you stop interrupting other people's questions? Okay, Jonathan, somebody's asking a question. It's not your press briefing. Julie's asking a question. Please calm down.
I mean, just the other day he sat down with Martin Luther King Jr. I would call him a civil rights leader.
Where his dad was the
third.
Leader.
Well, I think, Stace, because at the end of the day, let me answer...
I am okay,
but you know what? You're asking me a question, and I'm going to answer it, which is the president. I'm sorry. Please stop shaking your head again.
Can it be that it was Happy Valentine's Day. I can sense the love in the room.
At some point, April, you're going to have to take no for an answer with respect to whether or not there was collusion.
That's a ridiculous... You're basically... Okay, Kristen, we're going to end this right now. Hunter, no.
For all of the people who have concerns about this, especially on the right, look at the size.
Sean has two stacks of paper here, one large and one small.
This is the Democrats. This is us. There is, I mean, you can't get any clearer in terms of this is government, this is not. Someone as despicable as Hitler, who didn't even sink to using chemical weapons. He was not using the gas on his own people the same way that Assad is doing. I mean, there was clearly, I mistakenly used an inappropriate and insensitive reference to the Holocaust, for which, frankly, there is no comparison. And for that, I apologize. It was a mistake to do that.
Well, first of all, it's not a travel ban. He's using the words that the media is using.
The travel ban is not a ban, which makes it not a ban.
But you just called it a ban.
Because I'm using your words. You said ban. You said ban, now I'm saying it.
The
back
president
to you.
Tweeted, and I quote, yeah. If the ban were announced with a 1 week notice.
Yeah, exactly. You just said that. He's quoting you. It's your words. He's using your words. When you use the words and he uses them back, it's circular using of the word, and that's from you.
But at the end of the day, it can't. Hold on. It can't be. It can't
his
be.
Word is the extreme president day. Himself called it a ban.
I understand.
Is what? He confused or are you confused?
No, I'm not confused. The president used the word wiretap in quotes to mean broadly surveillance and other activities. His tweets do speak for themselves.
So, okay, but you just sort of interpreted it for Peter, saying, "Well, he didn't mean that President Obama
no,
had him. He didn't, when he said
wiretapping." That's not what I said. No. Actually,
he said when he meant wiretapping.
Right.
He said it. He meant surveillance.
No. Because he literally had it in quotes.
So instead of approaching reporters after he did a segment on Fox Business, he decided
to hide in the bushes rather than face all of the reporters standing there waiting to ask him about James Comey being fired.
Do you think people should be concerned that the president posted somewhat of an incoherent tweet last night and the defense stayed up for hours?
No.
Why did it stay up so long? Is no one watching this?
No, I think the president and a small group of people know exactly what he meant.
Will you guys just email where that wall is from exactly so we can identify location? Appreciate
Sean,
it.
Sean, thanks so much.
Sean,
please.
Sean.
Hey, Sean.
Sean.
Sean. Sean.
Now I'd like to begin today by apologizing on behalf of you to me for how you have treated me these last 2 weeks. And that apology is not accepted.
What's too painful to remember? We simply choose to.
We will miss you, Sean. Anyway, we'll take a quick break and be right back with Harold Pollack. We're going to play Harold in with the best thing I've seen in a while. This is Super Deluxe, and the song is titled Alex Jones Rants as an Indie Folk Song. Enjoy.
Store, the paradigm of absolute control. And that's why we're just out here doing simple things, pointing out that we're meant to be in nature and be natural. And this is where we find the source that God made to transcend the new world order. And that's why they want to try to keep us out of it.
I'm angry. I've had enough of these people. They're a bunch of Christian murderous scum. They're on giant death factories keeping babies alive and selling their body parts. What more do you need to know about these people? I go out and face these scum. They literally crawl out from under rocks. They have green looking skin and they run around screaming, we love Satan, we wanna eat babies. I have them on video.
Hillary's in the creepy weird sick stuff, man. She sleeps in the same room with that creepy weird woman whose mother wears a hood over her head. That woman number one is ugly. Imagine how bad she smells, man. I'm told her and Obama just stink. Obama and Hillary both smell like sulfur.
Literal vampire pot belly goblins are hobbling round coming out. Us. My spirit gets close to that evil and I feel it go.
We're such self-centered crap. We don't even notice and it's half rising up against us. Millions of pointed people of the very worst type and I'm so pissed. We're gonna steal your daughter at the mall.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm joined now by one of our favorite guests, mild-mannered healthcare wonk Harold Pollack. Harold is a public professor of public health at the University of Chicago. Harold, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio, and thanks so much for doing this on short notice.
Great to talk to you, Joshua.
So the zombie analogy seems right, or maybe Jason from Friday the 13th. Every time it seems like we've killed this repeal monster, it seems to rise up from the grave. It looks now like they're going to try to take a vote next week, but nobody in the Senate knows what they're going to vote on. What's happening here, Harold?
Well, I think you gave a pretty accurate description. It is kind of a shambolic process at the moment, but I think it's important to understand that it could well pass. You know, they are maybe a vote short And I think there's a ton of moderate Republicans who hope and assume that this is going to fail, but who don't want to be the person who makes it fail. And so I would not at all rule out the possibility that that they have some sort of a scrambled process and make enough changes at the last minute that they're able to just bring in, you know, get that 50th vote. It's a little more complicated because Senator McCain is out, but I would not at all rule out the possibility that that ACA gets repealed in some sort of a strange last minute vote that that nobody really wants, but nobody wants to be the one to stop.
Mitch McConnell saying maybe we'll repeal it now and replace it sometime in the next couple of years, maybe, perhaps. My own view is that at this point, it's Mitch McConnell wants to kind of hold a vote, not because he thinks this will pass. He wants to deliver a dead body to the GOP base so he can say, look, we tried, but we couldn't come together. And, you know, Democrats, obstruction, blah, blah, blah. Because he knows that this is eating up the congressional calendars, he knows that passing this will have some serious electoral consequences, and he really wants to move on to his true passion, which is cutting taxes for rich people. Your thoughts?
No, I think there's a lot to that. That you know, it has been you know, eating months and months and months of time, and it's been politically devastating, and you know, I'm sure that they want to put it behind them. But that doesn't mean that that they won't end up passing it. And I would be surprised if they passed a straight up repeal, because that, you know, since they have no, they've proven that their replacement, their ability to do a replacement is so limited that, you know, I think it would just put things in chaos if they did a straight up repeal with no obvious replace. But, you know, it's until a bunch of moderate Republicans say we're just not willing to see this thing proceed because it makes too many people uninsured, this thing is still there's still the possibility that they can grab the hockey mask and run out there and, you know, and get this thing done. And so I would not. You know, I think.
Yeah, it's really important to keep the pressure on.
Absolutely.
For 7 years, they've been saying that Obamacare is like worse than the plague or a planet destroying, you know, meteorite. And they've
yes,
really painted themselves
right
into the corner where now they have to, you know, pass a monstrosity or face a furious base. They're caught between a rock and a hard place of their own creation. So. Okay, let's say this fails. Trump has said at times that he'll let Obamacare crash and then the Democrats will come to him begging to make a deal. That last part, by the way, is just a sign of how delusional he is because, you know, I'm sure Dems would be happy to offer the necessary votes to shore up the ACA, but they're not going to help the GOP replace it with some right-wing catastrophe of a plan that kicks millions of
yeah.
people off of their insurance and decimates Medicaid. Now, we know that the ACA does have problems, but it is not in a death spiral, as Trump and others claim. Is that right?
Absolutely. And one of the problems that Republicans have, that what really painted them in a corner, was that they spent 7 years defining repealing Obamacare as providing people with better insurance, cheaper insurance. And in fact, they had no intention of actually proposing a bill that was even intending or designed to do that. And, you know, if they had spent 7 years saying we're going to repeal Obamacare, it's an abomination. And what we're going to do in its place is we're going to, you know, modify the, you know, the ACA exchanges, and we're going to allow people skinnier plans, and we're not going to touch Medicaid because that's not really a problem. They could have actually crafted something which they called an Obamacare repeal, which they actually could have passed, and would not have generated the kind of backlash that they're getting. But the problem was that they would have, it was irresistible to campaign against the parts of ACA that people didn't like, which was basically the high cost of people's health insurance. And since they wanted to make people's health insurance more expensive, that meant that they were going to spend 7 years using political rhetoric that just didn't match what they wanted to do when they actually got those levers of power. And one consequence of that, by the way, is if they do pass something next week, it will be one of the most shoddy and unprofessional pieces of legislation ever passed in this area. And so there's all the things that you and I don't like about the legislation that will be a big problem. There's also all of the screw-ups that we don't know about that will be baked in it just because they're producing it in such a shambolic fashion. And I would not underestimate at all the possibility that they will just create some complete embarrassing disasters that are just based on sort of the shoddiness of the work as opposed to any sort of an ideological desire or, you know, anything that they're intending to do. And so I'm sitting back and I'm watching this and I'm just thinking, wow, this is just an unbelievable process.
I mean, the repeal only bill is not even a serious piece of legislation. It was passed in 2015 when they were guaranteed an Obama veto. It leaves intact all of the market reforms because you can't pass those with 51 votes. You can't repeal those with 51 votes. But it removes all of the funding and the mandate that make those reforms work. And it kills the Medicaid expansion. So what you have is insurers would not be able to charge older people more. They would not be able to refuse people with pre-existing conditions. But then all of the things that, you know, make those things work are gone. It's a guaranteed death spiral. Now, the interesting thing is that although it's a lie that Obamacare is collapsing, this is one area where President Trump could make one of his lies come true. Is that right?
Well, yes and no. By the way, it's a lie that becomes a less effective lie when you telegraph it so completely. If you stand up on television and you say, I'm going to sabotage ACA and people are going to blame the Democrats, that makes it a little bit easier for the Democrats to simply say, let's roll the tape and tell people what happened. It is one of the more guileless efforts here that I don't think will work. One of the challenges...
That's shocking, Harold, because usually Donald Trump is so subtle and nuanced.
Yeah, he's known for that. Yeah, he's known for the sort of, yes, absolutely. Yes, I think Jeremy Irons should play him in the biopic with that sort of understated menace. He's sort of in the overstated menace category. You know, there's a couple of issues with that. One is that when Republicans control all three branches of government, it's kind of hard to blame the Democrats, especially after you've tried to do the process that they've gone through. And the second is that the places where this is going to hurt the most are really in the most Republican areas. You know, if you go to places like, you know, Los Angeles, New York City, Chicago, they're dense enough in their population and they have enough stakeholders committed to make them work that the exchanges aren't working great, but they are not, you know, they're just not in a state of collapse that, that President Trump is claiming. And he can certainly go and deeply, deeply hurt a lot of people in rural North Carolina, you know, the western states, particularly, you know, the sparsely populated states, his own political base. He can really hurt those people, but I don't get what he thinks the strategic logic that he's operating under, and I just think that it's so obvious what he's trying to do. Now, the sad part is I think what he can definitely do is hurt millions of people. He's already hurt millions of people. I was talking with a state official yesterday who was describing how because of the uncertainty over what's going to happen with ACA, that the state basically is not sure when, you know, how firm their Medicaid expansion is looking ahead. And therefore, it's harder now to get addiction treatment providers to expand their services, you know, in response to the opioid epidemic, because they're worried that the Medicaid resources just won't be there. They'll make a big investment, and then several years from now, that money won't be there. So it's already hurting people all over the country. And
yes, and private insurers are saying that they've already been pricing in the uncertainty around these CSR payments, payments to subsidize out-of-pocket costs for lower-income people. which have been in dispute. Republicans have contested their legality for the last couple of years. So people are already paying higher premiums for the uncertainty surrounding these payments, the fact that they might be cut off when they haven't actually been cut off. And then the Daily Beast reported this week that the government is using funds that are supposed to go to promoting the Affordable Care Act to attack it on social media. I mean, it's amazing. It's remarkable.
Yeah, Tom Price. And it is remarkable. It's a very unprofessional thing on top of everything else. And, you know, one thing that Republicans generally are very aware of is the importance of government to create an environment of policy certainty and predictability so that private businesses can do the work that they need to do. And, you know, because of the way Republicans have behaved, the federal government has just not been a good business partner for insurers. And when you're trying to set up this very complicated public-private partnership involved in making a market-based insurance system work, you know, they're really undermining it terribly. And it is, you know, if you go around the world and you look at systems like the Swiss system, which looks a lot like the Affordable Care Act exchanges in some ways, they really have found a way to make a market-based, predominantly private system work well because government is really doing it, you know, with its full commitment and energy and skill. And so companies can say, I can invest billions of dollars in this thing because I understand that everybody's behind this. And if you say to Blue Cross, well, we might, you know, we might lurch in some random direction depending on what happens next week. Please make a huge investment in, it's just not going to happen. And so it is one of the ironies of this is that the Republicans are destroying private market-based insurance in the individual and small group market. You know, the insurers are basically learning, I really can't trust the government to be a good long-term partner in this. So I've got to charge high premiums, and maybe I should just be in some other business because this is just a pain for us. You know, it's not like it's a huge profit center anyway. So, you know, why should I go into Western North Carolina to do this and deal with all the hassle if I can't even count on the federal government to have my back on the most basic things?
Well, if you want to talk about uncertainty, we have a debt limit fight coming up soon, and that should be fun. Last time Republicans played with the debt limit, they hurt the credit of the United States of America. If you're just tuning in, this is Politics and Reality Radio, and I'm speaking to Harold Pollack. The interesting thing is that Trump may actually believe that he won't own the fallout from sabotaging the Affordable Care Act because he's clueless about politics. I mean, I just hope that some of his advisors can get it through his head that he would indeed own it, whether or not it's justified, because that's just how it works. I mean, the president, whoever is in the White House is blamed or credited with the economy, with whatever's going on.
Yeah.
Rightly or wrongly, that is how it works. Harold, I want to switch gears a bit. Within the Democratic coalition, the discussion about health care appears to be shifting toward the left. You have mainstream Dems like Senator Kristen Gillibrand embracing Medicare for All.
Mm-hmm.
People who are seen as centrist technocrats like Matt Iglesias are saying the Sanders wing has won this battle. This is all good news from my perspective. But it seems like we have a conundrum. On the one hand, Medicare for All seems like excellent politics. Medicare is pretty popular. It's familiar. It's not a foreign, weird thing. Your grandmother or your mother is probably pretty happy with it. And the polls show that the public likes the sound of it. So it's really good politics. But on the other hand, and this is an issue that we really have to face, the activist left has made a litmus test of what may be the single most difficult route to getting to universal care, which is a rapid transition to Medicare for All. And I'm referring here to the Conyers plan in the House, which has 115 Democratic co-sponsors. That transitions us to Medicare for All in a year. It outlaws selling all but supplemental insurance after 1 year. Bernie Sanders has been saying for months, I think he first said it in, January, that he's going to introduce a Medicare for All bill any very soon. We're waiting on that. But the bill he introduced in 2013, that had a 2-year transition. I'd like to get your thoughts on this. Do you agree that this is like the rapid transition is the toughest way to get there? And if so, why does that represent such a challenge?
Well, it is a hard lift. And obviously, there actually has not been a detailed single-payer bill that has really been articulated, scored by the Congressional Budget Office, the transitional issues really laid out about how to get from here to there. You know, we've actually never seen that. And the details get to be, so difficult. And I've written about this before that if you, if you believe everything about how economical a single payer system would be compared to our current system, the financing required just to shift all of that stuff onto the federal budget would require roughly a doubling of the federal income tax if that's the vehicle that was used. So, there's many detailed questions about how are we really going to finance this? How do we deal with the shock to the system? If you think about, remember how much trouble President Obama got into when he said, if you like your insurance, you can keep it. And something like 1.6 million people, that promise turned out to be hard to keep. And that was, created a firestorm. And, here you would be transforming insurance for tens of millions of people, having massive tax changes and so on. So at one level, I think that is absolutely the hardest route to universal coverage. So I'm sort of more on the centrist side of the people that you mentioned. On the other hand, I think there's a couple of things that should be said. One is that actually a single payer system would genuinely be better than the American healthcare system. And people talk about it sometimes like it's some wild-eyed crazy thing. And in fact, single payer systems around the world are mostly better than the American healthcare system. And so it's, clearly if we could start from scratch, we could do a lot to make a good single payer system that would be more efficient and humane than the current system we have. I think that the left and liberals can come together on some sensible ideas that could really pass. I think if you say Medicare available to all, I think that a lot of people on the left and among liberals would really find that very compelling. Paul Starr has this idea of midlife Medicare, that people over the age of 50 should be able to get onto Medicare if they want. And, if we make it something that people can choose to do if they want to, and figure out how to provide that for people, I think there's a lot of people in the Sanders wing of the Democratic Party who could get behind that. And there's a lot of people who might be skeptical of single payer, but who also think that, the exchanges don't work that great and this should be an option for people. I think we can find a way for Democrats to coalesce around some of these ideas and move forward on them. And I don't think we should define this issue as let's either defend or critique single payer. It's really what can we do right now that moves us in a good direction that we can feel good about, that will both make our system more efficient and humane, and that will also allow us to achieve some of the values that the single payer folks, are really most passionate about. And there's a bunch of ways we can move forward. Nirvana was talking about people being able to buy into Medicaid. There's all kinds of ideas out there. And so I'm actually very optimistic that this is going to seem very fractious, but that we can actually find a way to make a coalition that makes progress.
I can't tell you how much I agree with that. And I should make it clear that I am an advocate of single payer. Absolutely. My problem again is with this rapid transition, and this specific policy is being used as a litmus test on the left, right? If you don't sign on to this idea of moving quickly to single payer through Medicare for all, then you're a neoliberal sellout. You're not a true progressive. And there's some irony to the fact that you have people on the left using single payer, using Medicare for all as a litmus test, right? But Medicare isn't a single payer system. This year, about one in three Medicare recipients will opt for a Medicare Advantage plan that they buy from a private insurer. And those are different insurance pools, right? So why even call it a single payer system? People say Canada is a single payer, but Canada has six provincial payers. Maybe we should have 50 payers through Medicaid. Maybe that's a better approach. I mean, I just think we should start at first principles. You know, everybody, healthcare, comprehensive healthcare, not access to healthcare in the emergency room, but comprehensive healthcare, including dental and mental healthcare, should be a right of all citizens. The government should assure that right. And then start at those first principles, and then let's have a talk about what is the best way to get there. So, I mean, we'd be asking 70%, around 70% of the non-elderly adult population to give up something they have for this other thing. And, you know, I mean, people aren't maybe in love with their health insurance, but if they get it through their employer, they're probably okay, right? And by the way, you wouldn't even be able to promise that you can keep your doctor because not all doctors would participate. And this all seems to run right into the concept of loss aversion, right? What is loss aversion, Harold?
Well, I think people are very, very nervous about losing something they have and losing something valuable in the status quo. And people will value being able to avoid a loss much more highly than they will value the potential gain they might get from a different system. And so that natural kind of conservatism that people have, which you know, shows up in all sorts of ways. If I ask you to buy, if I hold up a really nice coffee mug and I say, how much will you pay me for this coffee mug? You'll say like $5. And then I hand you the mug and you sort of sit with it and look at it for 5 minutes. And then I say, how much would I have to pay you to get that mug back? You'll be like $10. It's now part of your status quo. And, you know, and there's just nothing more intimate than our health insurance and more complicated. And, you know, one thing that I think it's this, the current Republican political debacle, whatever results from it, I think should teach us a couple of lessons. And, you know, one lesson for Democrats is, you know, most Americans actually do believe in universal coverage. And I think the idea that we're going to do this thing and it's going to be great, but it's going to make 20 more million Americans uninsured, I think the reaction among the American public is, no, we don't do that. You know, we don't take away people's Medicaid. We don't take away people's health insurance. Everybody deserves that. And I never really thought about it before, but now that you're putting it in my face, I really believe that everyone needs to be insured. And I think there's a consensus there that we can build on. But there's also a lesson, you know, trying to do these super radical things in one jump when you get a political opportunity, boy, you really better know what you're talking about because healthcare, you're talking about 1/6 of the U.S. economy. And there is this incredible resistance from all sorts of sources to just taking that thing and hitting it with a sledgehammer. And so it's not enough to have a vision, an aspiration of what you want the system to be. You also have to have a sense of how am I going to get people there where they feel that it's safe for them and it's answering the questions that they care about. And all the different stakeholders involved, maybe it's a rural hospital that's worried about going out of business if they get squeezed too hard by a government program. Maybe it's people who have nice employer-based insurance. Maybe it's people on Medicaid who actually are worried about how you might change that if you change, you know, if you fundamentally went to a different system. You know, there's so many different constituencies involved that I think that we have to think a lot harder about not just where are we trying to get to, but what's the path to get there that's kind of workable. And I think it was really interesting to me, for example, in this, you know, in the past debate over the Republican efforts, how all these Republican governors are suddenly saying, you know, you can't take away Medicaid from people. And giving governors ownership over universal coverage seems to be really helpful in making it more sustainable. You know, imagine we have a single payer system, and then President Trump and Secretary Price are the people running it. You know, that's a little scary. You know,
Right. I think the takeaway here is that if we are to achieve universal health care in this country, we have to go and grapple with the challenges of getting there. We can't just blame feckless Democrats for not passing half-cooked bills that have no chance of working. You know, no country has transitioned to a universal health care plan when they were spending 16% of their economic output on health care. All these countries started their plans or enacted their plans in the wake of World War II. They were spending 2 or 3 or 4% of their GDPs on healthcare. This is a huge sector of the economy. It employs a lot of people. We're going to fail if we don't grapple with the challenges of getting from here to there.
I so agree with you that there's no immaculate conceptions in health policy, and that every country gets to universal coverage in its own way, consistent with its own path. But the second is kind of implicit in your conversation about litmus tests. You know, we have to be good to each other as progressives. And one of the things that I really worry about is, you know, it's such an angry time, and we have to make sure that we channel that anger appropriately and not circular firing squad this thing. And, you know, liberals and progressives really need each other. And so I think that many of us realize that we're going to fight about lots of things, and it's going to be a big fight about who's the, you know, Democratic nominee in 2020 or whatever. But all the people that you mentioned, you know, in the beginning of the podcast, share common values, and we have to always remember that.
Harold Pollack, mild-mannered healthcare wonk. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break, and then be right back with Gleb Saporsky.
Well, you've got your diamonds, and you've got your pretty clothes, and the chauffeur drives your car. You let everybody know, but don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. Your mother, she's an heiress, owns a block in St. John's Wood, and your father 'd be there with her if he only could. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. Took her diamonds and tiaras by the score. Now she gets her kicks in Stepney, not in Knightsbridge anymore. So don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. Now you've got some diamonds, we'll have some others, but you better watch your step, girl, or start living with your mother. So don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. So don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Gleb Saporsky. Gleb's a historian at Ohio State University. He's also the president of a nonprofit group called Intentional Insights, and he is the author of the upcoming book, The Alternative to Alternative Facts, Fighting Post-Truth Politics with Behavioral Science. Gleb, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks so much for having me on, Joshua. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for taking the time. A poll came out this week. It found that 1 in 3 Trump supporters believe that Donald Trump Jr. and other senior staffers did not meet with a Russian lawyer offering dirt on Hillary Clinton. And the thing that makes that so remarkable is that Donald Jr. went on Fox News and said he met with her. And in fact, he tweeted out the whole email chain leading up to the meeting, but they believe nonetheless that it is fake news. How did we get here to this remarkable place of post-truth politics?
Well, we can also look back at what's the current belief among Republicans that Obama wiretapped Trump Tower, which has been, you know, said to be wrong by so many news outlets, so many media outlets, and they still believe that, or that Donald Trump won the popular vote, which more than half the Republicans still believe. So, yes, this is definitely a very big problem. We can look at what was happening to ordinary people and fake news sharing on Facebook in the 3 months before the election. So in the 3 months before the election, the top 20 Facebook fake news stories that were engaged with at a higher rate than the top 20 true news stories, something like 8 million engagements versus 7 million engagements, according to a BuzzFeed news analysis. So people are sharing fake news widely, and it's coming about from a couple of factors. One is deterioration of trust in mainstream media, which has been going down extremely rapidly, especially in 2016 from 2015 with the Trump effect. So we see Republicans, the trust in mainstream media among Republicans has dropped by more than half, according to Gallup polls, from 2015 to 2016. More than half. That's ludicrous, but it's true.
Yes.
So that's one. Second is social media. People are getting their news from social media, from Trump's tweets, from Donald Trump Jr.'s tweets, and so on. They're getting their news extensively from social media, and they trust the social media to be an accurate conveyor of news versus mainstream media. And of course, there's so much fake news on social media, as I pointed out a minute ago, about the fake news stories on Facebook in the 3 months prior to the election. So these are the two huge driving dynamics of this phenomenon.
And one other that I'd point out is just the dynamic of media siloing, where people seek out media outlets, and there's an increasing number of partisan media outlets, both on the left and the right, that conform to their worldviews. There was a study recently that found that conservatives were somewhat more likely to avoid media outlets that did not conform with their ideological belief systems. So you're championing a way of combating this problem that's grounded in behavioral science. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So the pro-truth pledge at protruthpledge.org, for folks who want to follow along, again, that's protruthpledge.org, is a new behavioral science instrument that is aimed to address lies in politics. It combines behavioral science and crowdsourcing through having 12 behaviors that research in behavioral science suggests are most likely to lead to truth. We're not telling you what the truth is. These are just truth-oriented behaviors. It's about a process. I'll give you an example. One is fact-check information to confirm it is true before accepting and sharing it. Another is ask people to retract information that reliable sources have disproved, even if those people are my allies. And a third is celebrate those who retract incorrect statements and update their beliefs toward the truth. And there are 9 more like this. So anyone looking at them would agree that, yes, these are truth-oriented activities, behaviors. So that's one. That's the behavioral science. Now, the crowdsourcing is how this pledge is maintained and spread. We have ordinary citizens from all walks of life throughout the United States and even the world signing the pro-truth pledge and committing to it. That way, they give incentives to public figures to sign the pro-truth pledge because they know that that ordinary citizens are paying attention to it, and these public figures get a reputation boost from signing the pro-truth pledge and putting the pro-truth pledge badge on their website, being listed as advocates of the pro-truth pledge on the pro-truth pledge website. Then the ordinary citizens who sign the pledge, a portion of them can volunteer to help. One of the ways that they volunteer to help is monitoring these public figures who sign the pro-truth pledge. So it's very much a combination of behavioral science and crowdsourcing to give incentives to public figures to sign the pro-truth pledge and then monitor and evaluate them to make sure they stick to it.
And so how many people have taken the pledge so far? Folks, again, this is www.protruthpledge, all one word, .org. How many folks have taken the pledge so far, Gleb?
Around 1,600 something ordinary citizens and around 100 plus public figures, including some pretty well-known public figures, people like Steven Pinker, Peter Singer, leaders of prominent organizations such as the United Coalition of Reason, a number of media figures and journalists such as Ethan Behrman, who is the number 57 talk show host in the United States, appears often on CNN and Fox, and of course politicians from around the country.
And you've seen some, at least anecdotal evidence, that this is an effective way. So you're basically trying to set up, if we look at the big picture and step back, you're setting up... you're attempting to set up an independent system that provides some disincentives for spreading fake news, for making inaccurate statements, and some incentives for taking the truth seriously. And you say that you've seen at least some anecdotal evidence of its effectiveness, right?
Absolutely. We have some impact stories on the website that folks can go to. It's going to be in FAQ 5, what is the impact of the pro-truth pledge? For example, there was a candidate for Congress, Michael Smith. He took the pro-truth pledge. He then posted on Facebook a screenshot of a tweet by Donald Trump criticizing minority and disabled children in classrooms. Now, after being called out on it, he went and searched Donald Trump's feed. It wasn't there, so you know, maybe Donald Trump deleted it, or maybe it was Photoshopped to look like Donald Trump's feed. And then he edited his statement on Facebook, which by that time had 18 shares, so you know, pretty big share rate. He said that due to a pro-truth pledge I have taken, I can't say that I verify this post. That's an example. Another was a Christian pastor and community leader, Lorenzo Neal. He took the pledge, and he told me how, having taken the pledge himself, he puts forth the effort to continually gather information, validating stories and headlines before sharing them on his social media outlets, and a number of other things like this, where we have clear evidence of behavior change as a result of people taking the pro-truth pledge.
Folks, you can read a piece that Gleb wrote just discussing this in greater detail, also discussing some of the evidence for the efficacy of this kind of approach. It's obviously a voluntary approach. It fits in the larger sense of nudging people into different behaviors. It's titled How to Address the Epidemic of Lies in Politics. It's at scientificamerican.com. You can Google that, Gleb Sapursky. And of course, you can go and take the pledge at protruthpledge.org. Gleb, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Joshua. I really appreciate it too. And I'm curious, has our conversation moved you toward taking the pro-truth pledge yourself?
I am going to take the pro-truth pledge myself as soon as I'm done recording this week's radio show.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Joshua. You have a great day.
Thanks. You too, Gleb. Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Susie Madrak to talk about what Trump calls the Russia thing. Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland. I'm joined now by an OG blogger. Susan Madrak is a contributing editor to Crooks and Liars, which is gracious enough to let us park this show over at their joint every week. Susie, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Oh, thanks for having me, Josh.
Thanks for taking the time. Have you ever seen anything like this week? I always think, okay, we've hit a tipping point, and then we haven't hit a tipping point. The New York Times interview with Donald Trump was extraordinary. He basically railed about everybody in the Justice Department, the current interim FBI director, the old FBI director, the attorney general, the assistant attorney general. And although they didn't put it in the paper, I think he probably bitched about the White House groundskeeper.
Well, you know, one of the things that drives people nuts about me, my friends, is that while they're very much into the process and strategy of politics, I'm very much into the psychology. Like I always say, you can't figure out anything about these people if you don't understand their psychology. And his, I mean, I don't know what the clinical term is, but I just say that he's nuts. He's just nuts.
Narcissism, right?
It's malignant. It's compulsive narcissism. He literally can't be wrong. He can't be wrong. He can't be caught. You know, so like, how many times have you seen any grown up tell you, "No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that." Like you have it on tape, but they you didn't say. You know.
That's not my words. Those are your words.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, I think what interests me more than him is the psychology of people who still believe him.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead.
You know, because there's so much factual evidence out there now that he's the compulsive liar, and all these people somehow convince themselves that people like us, who are having nervous breakdowns over the things that are happening to the country, they think we're making.
It's remarkable. I also wish we were. Now, this idea. So, okay, the idea of counting on Republicans to fulfill their constitutional duty for once in their pathetic lives seems far-fetched. That's a fool's errand. And yet, I have seen a half of a dozen interviews with Republican senators and members of Congress who said that if Donald Trump follows through on his threat to fire Robert Mueller, the special prosecutor, they will have no choice. He will essentially force their hand and make them take their oversight responsibilities seriously. Your thoughts?
Well, as Rick Wilson says, who, you know, the Republican consultant, they will continue to be concerned.
I mean,
you know, will they actually do anything? I who knows? If his numbers go lower, I mean, he's 36 now. If his numbers get below 30, then I think we'll see them start to take their job seriously. But and if there's any risk at all for elected Republicans, they're not going to do anything.
Isn't the key number the Republican approval rate? Because that is still over 80%.
Well, I don't know that people are that concerned, because you saw when they had that luncheon meeting at the White House the other day when he was talking to them about supporting the next health care bill, the repeal vote.
Yeah.
And afterwards, when they were talking to the press, they were basically saying, "We're not afraid of him. He, you know, we're going to do what we think is right." That's new.
Well, let me ask you this, Susie. In order for him, he can't fire Mueller. He has to order Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein to fire Mueller. One presumes that he would resign if asked to do that. He said that he would not do that if it were an unlawful, what he thinks of as an unlawful order. So then you have a true Saturday night massacre thing where the next person up, he has to fire that person if they resign, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we still have a functional media. You can assume that the neutral press, so I'm not saying that those of us, you know, writing for The Nation or whatever, or Crooks and Liars, but I'm saying the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, blah, 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 would not treat that as a normal thing. This would be an abnormal thing to such a great degree after the firing of Comey. Are we being too cynical when we say that Republicans wouldn't care?
I don't think so.
Isn't there a point where it's just like so dramatic?
I think you're giving the media too much credit. I mean, this morning, you know, from watching the media all day, we see a continuing attempt to normalize what Trump said in those stories that broke last night about, you know, looking into the pardons and looking for ways to attack Mueller and his team. They're saying, well, you know, the Clinton people tried to do the same thing with Ken Starr, you know, by calling it a political witch hunt. Well, here's the difference, as I think you know. It really was a political witch hunt with the Clintons.
Right.
I mean, what else was there to call it? It was a made-up thing that went on for years, that there was first an investigation, and the person who headed that investigation didn't find any criminal activity, and he didn't find what they wanted, which was they wanted them to say that Vince Foster was murdered.
Right.
Instead of having committed suicide. So then they bring in Ken Starr, who is a rabidly partisan Republican, who was part of the whole plan to get Bill Clinton. And yes, it really was political. And the New York Times, somehow, all these years later, even with a completely different set of reporters, is still fixated on the idea that somehow the Clintons got away with something.
Well, I mean, the key difference here is that, as you said, Ken Starr wasn't just a Republican. And you can be an honest Republican, especially if you're a prosecutor, if you're supposed to be in the judicial branch, which is less politicized, at least somewhat less politicized. He was an ideologue, a true believer. This is not the case with Robert Mueller,
right,
who may be a Republican even, although I think that's unclear. But Robert Mueller has
I don't know.
But that's the point. We don't know. He's not a hardcore, you know, either leftist or rightist ideologue who goes around breathing fire. He has a sterling reputation, former Marine, decorated Marine. I think that they're biting off more than they can chew. And I'll just add this. I think that Robert Mueller he does not care about these threats. He has a broad mandate to investigate potential collusion, but also anything else which may arise during the investigation of potential collusion. The thing with Russia and the Trumps, it starts with money. There's no question about that. And I think that he's put together this team of, you know, an A team of prosecutors and investigators, many of whom have a lot of experience with complex conspiracies, with money laundering, with financial crimes. And this is going to end badly for Donald Trump and his associates. I don't see any other way. Anyway, Susie, I believe we are out of time. I ran over with Harold Pollack, so I didn't have as much time with you as I would have liked to have taken, but I do really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
Oh, sure.
I'd also like to thank Harold Pollack and Gleb Sapursky. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean, wherever else you can find it. I'd like to thank Digby at Hullabaloo, the good folks at Crooks and Liars, the good folks at Smirking Chimp, for letting me host the show at their respective joints. Of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.